Carol, thank you so much for joining us today. We really, really appreciate you giving up your time to talk about your Greenham stories. Could I start by asking you what brought you to Greenham? So how did you become involved in Greenham in the first place?
It's a long time ago. I mean, it's a really long time ago. I'd just come out of care. I was in care. And I got a job at the Fabian Society in their bookshop. And I was sitting in Soho Square having my lunch. And I saw a newspaper. I think it must have been the Evening Standard. And it said something about a rainbow bomb. And I remember thinking, that is really obscene. You know, the rainbows, you know, make a rainbow bomb. And I rang up CND and asked what was going on. And they said, oh, there's a coach going to Greenham on Saturday. So I was 16. I didn't know anybody. And I said, OK, book me on the coach, which they did. And I went to Greenham, told my mum I'd be back that night. And then the police came along and said, time to clear the gate now. And some of the guys there said, well, we're not going. And I said, why aren't you going? And they told me why they weren't going. So I thought, oh, I'm not going either. So I stayed overnight. And I remember cuddling down in a sleeping bag with a guy called Tim, I think. And he ended up editing a radical newspaper in a couple of years. I can't remember his name. And the next morning, a furniture van arrived and the police said, you either move or we're going to arrest you. And I remember thinking, that's a bit pushy and it's quite important. So I just sat there and taken to Reading Jail. And I'd read Oscar Wilde. It wasn't quite how I'd imagined Reading Jail.
Yeah.
And then we came up into the magistrates, Newbury magistrates, on the Monday. And they said that I had to be bound over to keep the peace. Yeah. And I refused to give my name and my date of birth, and I refused to be bound over. And there was nothing they could do. I mean, they obviously knew I was a bit on the young side. So that's how I spent my first week in Holloway on remand.
So you spent a week in Holloway at the age of 16?
Yeah, which is really unusual.
Yes.
I remember looking over the balcony with a vicar's daughter called Alison. And I was saying, I didn't know they had men in Holloway. And she said, oh, they're not men, they're lesbians. And I didn't like to ask really, because it seemed a bit stupid, because, you know, everybody nodded wisely. I didn't know what they were talking about. I think Helen Alagranza was down there and Pat Arrowsmith, people I met years later.
Yeah.
And then when we came back in court after a week, my mum had sent my sort of boyfriend who worked at The Economist with her. And he paid the fine, and I was furious. But so that was my first encounter with Greenham. And then years and years, and then I married my barrister from that action at Greenham, yeah, and had three children. And I was at Tenby on holiday. It must have been beginning of the 1980s, and we'd been out on the beach all day, and I was looking out of the window at night. And there was nobody on the beach. There was no kids. There was no laughter. There was no dogs. There was no sound of anything. And I was doing a postgraduate teaching degree. And I thought, what the fuck's the point of teaching history when there might not be any history? Mm. And I sat down that night and wrote to the university and said, I'm leaving. And I thought, I'm going to leave college, but I'm going to go to Greenham. And I did.
Wow. So the first time you agreed, because you talked about Helen Alagranza being in Holloway. So what year was that?
Must have been 1961 or 62.
Yeah, maybe. Really early 60s.
Really, really. Yeah.
Wow. Okay. So I don't know if I'd realised it, but I mean, I knew there were the action, you know, the big walk and the action at Trafalgar Square, but I don't know if I'd realised that actions actually took place at Greenham that early.
I don't know how many there were, whether that was just a random sort of action, but,
yeah,
you know, it was certainly an issue already.
Yeah.
And the Committee of 100 were, you know, concerned about it, so.
So what brought you back to Greenham? You were talking there about being on the bit in, you know, talking about not being any history, so kind of ending your teaching degree.
Yeah.
And then did you go straight back to Greenham then?
No, I sort of rang up, found out what was going on, and then there was Embrace the Base.
Yes.
And I knew that, you know, some of the women had gone from Wales, but I didn't know them, and I hadn't gone on the walk. But when I saw Embrace the Base, I thought, right, I'll go. So I got again, so rang up, got a coach, and went on Embrace the Base. And sort of what you described, really, you suddenly found yourself holding hands with thousands, literally thousands of women. Mm. And it was, you just knew it was a moment, and that if we didn't, and we were all, people had pictures of their kids and their grandchildren up on me. Mm. And it was wonderful. It was also heartbreaking because we knew that it was really serious. It was, you know, the height of the Cold War, and it could happen. And then we went into the Cuba crisis, you know, the following year, and we knew it really could happen. So. Yeah. And people were talking. Sorry, John.
No, go on.
No, people were talking about a big action on New Year's Day. And I thought, yeah, I could do that. No, there's no good just sort of turning up. You know, if I'm really serious about this, I need to be really serious about it.
Yeah.
So I went back, and it was a big decision. And I have tremendous guilt about it because I left my kids and my mum. You know, I left my kids with my mum, but I left them all on Christmas Eve. And my professor, Gwen Williams, drove me up, looked terrified at all the women, dropped me, drove off. And it was an odd experience because the women were all sitting around the fire, but they were quite cool, not in a cool way, but in a little bit frosty way. Nobody said hello or anything. And months later, one of the women said to me, oh, if I'd have known you were a friend of my, I won't name her, my friend, we'd have, you know, we'd have come up and talked to you. And I thought, well, fuck that. That shouldn't be.
Yeah.
You know, that's... It was very white, very middle class, and I didn't think you should have to be a friend of a friend, really.
No.
So I wasn't.
What gate was that? Do you know?
Main gate, yeah. Mm-hmm. Green gate, yeah. Yellow gate. Can't remember the main gate.
Yeah, yellow was main gate. Yeah.
Yeah. But it, you know, it's Christmas Eve. It was. But then, you know. It was okay, and I started to talk to people and heard about the silo action. I thought, yeah, that sounds like a really good idea.
Mm. And then, so you took part in the silo action. Do you want to talk us through what happened?
Well, I went home, you know, still feeling guilty about leaving them. And I went home to tell them I was going to leave them again, so I obviously didn't feel that much guilt. But I thought the idea of actually trying to prevent work on the silos themselves. Mm. I thought it was a really good idea. So I went back and we planned it. And I remember thinking at the time we went into, was it Basingstoke, somewhere quite near, and we bought aluminium ladders. We bought old secondhand carpet. Rebecca contacted, you know, did a wonderful job contacting the press. Every single hotel and bed and breakfast, and it was full of journalists and film crews. And I just thought, we're never going to get away with this. You know, gangs of women buying ladders and journalists, you know, we're just never, ever going to get away with it. And I think one of the things I learned then is never overestimate the intelligence of the British state. Because we turned up just before dawn on New Year's Day with ladders and old carpets and as many journalists and film crews as you could have fitted in Manchester. And there was no police there. There was nobody there. I couldn't believe it. Kate Adey was standing behind me. And I heard her say, oh, I think we're breaking the Official Secrets Act. I thought, yeah, I think you're dead right. We are breaking the Official Secrets Act. And one of the women who went over the fence before me was called Nell Logan, who became a close friend. And she was I thought she was older than God in those days. She was 75. And she'd stuffed her, you know, all her clothes and stuff with newspapers to prevent the dogs biting her.
Mm.
And over she went, and over I went, and over we all went. And then we just ran, and then suddenly we saw the lights from the police car. But it was inside the base. It was just amazing that nobody had sussed it, really. And we sort of ran up the hill to the top of the silo. And just as, it all sounds very romantic, but just as the sun started to come up, the dawn started to break, we were on top of the silo and holding hands, dancing against anti-clockwise and singing. Then we sat down, and then we got wet, and then we got arrested.
Mm. That's such an iconic image, that image, yeah, of you all on the silos and with the police cars in the foreground.
Yes, yeah. And we got, I can't remember what happened to us. Did we get taken? Maybe we were kept in the cells overnight. Do you know, I can't remember, but eventually we were released. And then we had a big court case, I think, in Newbury, where Liz Woodcraft was, what an incredible barrister, wonderful woman.
Yeah.
And, you know, lots of people from all over the world gave, I think Professor Alice Stewart gave evidence, people gave incredible evidence. It was really powerful. And we got found guilty and packed into a riot van. And everybody, lots of people complained about being put in a riot van. And I just could never see the reason for the complaint, because if you threaten the biggest financial deals in history, then you're a fucking terrorist and you should be treated like a terrorist. You know, what would they have done? Okay, girls, you've made your point, you know, go home. Mm-hmm. That would be much more insulting than the riot van, I think. But I'm quite small, and I couldn't see out of the window properly, so I balanced up on the seat, and then they slammed the brakes on, and I must have hit the wall. Mm-hmm. And then I don't really remember anything until we got to Holloway. But when I got into Holloway, I started being really sick. And one of the prisoners who were already there sort of said she needs to see a doctor. And I think the doctor came and gave me great dollop of phenobarbitone, but I was clearly concussed. And somebody wrote, a journalist wrote a piece in the New Statesman. So I then saw the doctor, who stopped giving me phenobarbitone. But going to the prison hospital in those days was a real eye-opener. I mean, it was horrific. It was just women who'd lost their babies there. Mm-hmm. And doctors who'd really not been nice. It was the old Holloway was horrific. But the new Holloway was more horrific in a different way. It was less human. It was unkinder, I think.
Yeah.
So I think we've got 2 weeks, I think.
That's interesting, you seeing the prison in the early 60s and then the early 80s.
Yeah.
And seeing the difference between the two stays.
I think the second time was worse.
Because
everybody was so, it must have been awful in the old one. I mean, it was more gothic, you know. They gave you a bath, and the bath was, you know, the size of the Thames. But it was, I don't think it was as unkind as the new Holloway, you know, to women.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Mm. So what, when you came out of Holloway, what made you decide to stay? So how long did you stay at Greenham for?
Well, once I'd done the, you know, these things sort of gather their own momentum, don't they? We came out of that. I mean, there were some funny things in Holloway. I remember the women protesters outside trying to climb in, which, of course, the other prisoners thought were hilarious. I mean, yeah. They were used to people breaking out, but breaking in was a bit different. And we were taken to, I think it was the Old Bailey for something about evictions and bailiffs. So But instead of we formed a circle in the Old Bailey and we tried the judge and found the judge guilty. So there was, you know, we were quite busy in there.
What did that look like? You tried the judge. Can you just talk us through exactly what?
Yeah, I think it was outside the main courtroom. And I think we all sat down in a big circle and blocked the corridor. And I can't remember what we found him guilty of, poor bugger, but we did. So, but when we came out of Holloway after the fortnight, we had no idea what an impact the silo action had had, and the images had gone all around the world. We had no idea. And there were loads of, you know, camera crews and reporters and stuff outside. And that sort of gathered its own momentum. What are you going to do next? So we had to, you know, we had to think what we were going to do next. I can't remember what we did next immediately. But it sort of led to the American court case, you know, the Supreme Court. So, and people used to say, well, why don't... Sorry.
You went over to America, to New York for that.
Yeah. And people used to say, why don't you try the law? So we thought, okay, we'll try the law, which we did. I think we were, don't know how many plaintiffs there were. And when I went, I said to my kids and my mum, this one's okay, we're the plaintiffs. We won't get locked up, you know, I promise you, there'll be no prison involved. Mm-hmm. And I really believe that. But there was an interesting, I won't call it a split, I'll call it a dichotomy, in the thinking of the group that went over there, both the lawyers and the plaintiffs. And one of the things that we were offered was money to buy proper clothes, you know, a set of clothes, so we could meet senators. Mm. And some of us, in a particular Welsh contingent, reckoned that we really didn't want to dress up, you know, to meet senators. They needed to meet us as who we were. Mm. So that was the first split. And then there was a sort of, we were divided and we were sent on, sorry, we danced the phone, sent on lecture tours. And mine was sort of, I think I gave a lecture at Massachusetts Institute of Technology and Harvard and, you know, places like that. But one of my fellow speakers was Weinberger, and he looked as though he'd been dead for years. His hair was all blue. It was weird. But, you know, and that was, but there was a weird thing as well. It was almost the King's touch, you know, that Green and women were sort of somehow that special, that people would touch you in the street. And that was kind of weird. And I remember opening the Tom Paine Memorial Centre. And in one, at one level, one could see that you were in the, you know, the line of radical protesters, but there was, I don't know, I didn't like the celebrity stuff, I guess. Mm. I mean, I understand it's very useful, and I do understand that, but it depends what you do with it, doesn't it? You shouldn't let it go to your head, I guess. So some of us felt that, I mean, we had the first part of the court case, and one of the Welsh women was thrown out for breastfeeding her baby in court. And outside there were sort of shops and sort of pawn shops of pictures of women with their tits hanging out, all, you know. But, you know, she got thrown out for breastfeeding her baby. Mm. So it was sort of split up then, and went on these lecture tours. But those of us who felt a bit strongly about it decided that if they did cite cruise missiles well in the adjournment, we'd go back to the United Nations and chain ourselves to the United Nations. And the buggers did cite cruise missiles while we were in that adjournment week. So we went back, met at the UN, met some American women. We all chained ourselves together and got arrested. My eldest son was at the London School of Economics at the time. And I promised them all that we wouldn't get arrested. And he was watching the news in the common room. And he saw these red boots with yellow laces going into the back of the van. Seemingly he turned to his friends. It's my mum. And it was. So we drove into New York in this police van. I don't know what it is about their use of the brake, but they slammed the brake on. The door flew open. We all jumped out, all chained together. We were dancing through the rush hour traffic, all chained together, and they caught us again. But yeah, that was good fun. And we went into the sort of central holding centre, and the police women were really apologetic about having to sort of strip search us, and they understood what, you know, why we were doing what we were doing. And we were in this sort of hamster cage overnight with loads of other women. And, you know, that was, God, that was a education in itself. Mm. Because a lot of the women had been in there because they'd had sex with guys and the guys had paid them for sex.
Yeah.
And then arrested them because the guys they'd had sex with were policemen. And I think I must have been a bit naive at the time because I was really shocked by that. But there was the women who taught us how to play backgammon or something, so we gambled through the night and then got chucked out the next day and sent back to Britain to deal with the fact that, you know, cruise missiles were actually now sighted in Britain.
So you had your family, but did you keep then going to Greenham for long stays or for weekends, or what did it look like the rest of your time with Greenham?
I think it depended what was going on, because I had, you know, I had sort of, well, I was supposed to have had domestic responsibilities, you wouldn't guess, actually. I think when there was an action, that we'd go up, you know, the Welsh women, we'd go up in a group, and they wanted somebody to go. There was going to be a summit, Reagan Thatcher summit in Geneva, and they wanted women to go to that. So the Welsh women, we went over to Geneva. I think Julie Christie paid for it. I don't know if that's just a myth, but we went over to Geneva and stayed in John Berger's flat in Geneva. Sadly, John Berger wasn't there. But it sort of all went well, and we just sort of, you know, did the usual talks and protests and stuff like that. But then we put, there's a sort of iconic flower clock in the middle of Geneva, and we got a big sheet and we made a clock to fit over it that said 5 minutes to midnight. And the police didn't like that, so they arrested us. Took us to the airport. And my experience of the police in Britain, on the whole, if you talk to them, you know, they're pretty good, they will listen to you. But the police, especially the airport police in Geneva, we were taken into the chief of police's room. And he had a big calendar up on the wall with a woman with, you know, no bra on. And it was really offensive, you know, even by pornographic calendar standards. And so he left us in there, and there was a large black marker pen on his desk. And I thought I'd leave him a message about it. But he came in as I was doing it, grabbed me by the neck and held me down on me. And I really thought he was going to choked me, and the other women sort of jumped up. But yeah, he had my head in the crooks of his arm, and he just closed his arm on my neck. But that's the only time really I've had any real violence from the police. And they drove us in a sort of blue flashing light van to the aircraft, and the aircraft was waiting. It was one of those really posh ones where people pay a fortune. It was full of businessmen. And they put us right in the back. And when we were up in the air, one of the guys with the trolley comes down the back. And he said, oh, this is from... He looked at the trolley and it had champagne and smoked salmon and sort of crusty bread. I mean, we thought, God, that looks good for somebody. And it was a present from the pilot and the crew. So if you're going to get deported from Switzerland. And we got back. It was we could hear the news of us coming back over the tannoy. So, you know, obviously it had made, and you sort of realise then that you don't have to, you know, if you do things, they do get reported, mostly. Yeah. Unless you're Boris Johnson, of course, and they don't, but.
Yes.
And we sort of went on from there. We did lots of stuff. We did lots of stuff in Wales, and I should remember all the. I should have written all the notes down at least. So I remembered what we'd done. But
so, are you from Wales?
I'm from Scotland.
From Scotland originally.
But I've lived in Wales most of my adult life. Yeah.
When, because you talked early on about leaving care. So, were you in care in Scotland or in Wales?
No, in London.
Ah, right.
In East Finchley. I was in the Convent of the Good Shepherds, you know, for girls who had to be taken into care for their own safety. I'd lived rough on the streets of London for a week when I was 12 or 13 and managed perfectly well, to be honest. But the convent, the Good Shepherd Convent, was a very different place, you know. I remember the only teacher, Mother Francesca, looking at us all in the class and saying, "You're all tarred with the same brush." And so we were the one, you know, it was our fault that we were there. Yes, it was. And it was my first introduction to women being punished for being women. We were in St. Joseph's, half of the care centre. It was a boarding school. And if you went into the chapel, you could hear the girls in Our Lady's side. We never met them, we never saw them, but you could hear them. And mostly they were unmarried mothers, and their babies were taken away from them. And you could hear them, sometimes they turned the water hoses on them. And you could hear them. I've never quite, I don't know what to call it. It was when I moved to next door to a dairy farm in Wales, when they shoot the male calves, the cows make a terrible wailing noise. And that's what those girls made. You could hear when they'd taken the babies away from them. And it's not something you ever forget, or you should ever forget, really. But I was actually made deputy head girl for a week. But then I refused to stand up for God Save the Queen and the Queen's birthday, so I lost my badge. But the Mother Superior, Mother Lewis, said, "Well, you can go and meet your MP. You and the head girl can go and meet your MP. But you'll have to give an undertaking that, you know, you won't behave badly." And I couldn't give the undertaking, so I wasn't allowed to go. But our MP was Maggie Thatcher, which I don't know. Yeah, if I'd have known. But when I came back from being in Holloway when I was 16, I went back to the Fabian Society. My boss called me in, and she actually said to me, "It's very good that you're taking politics seriously, but you must never let it interfere with your work." Years later, I was on a platform with her. She was Shirley Williams, who's just died. And I reminded her that she told me that I shouldn't let it interfere with my work. Yeah, it was how people think that vulnerable kids need to be cared for. I'm not sure. I hope it's changed a lot, but I'm not sure it has.
I think to a certain extent, but there's still a lot of work to do, I think.
Yeah.
So how did you end up in Wales from East Finchley?
Well, I got married to the guy who was my barrister when I was in Holloway when I was 16. I married him. He was a lawyer. He became a law lecturer. And he got offered a job in Cardiff. So that's why we moved to Cardiff, yeah.
So you've talked a little bit about your son. What was the impact on your children of your activism, both positive and negative?
Well, I've got two sons and a daughter. My daughter has started a nursery schools that they're sort of taking it one step further, you know, sort of outdoor schools and stuff, but she's taken it one step further with children, very sort of libertarian, you know, open air nursery schools. They don't go indoors at all.
Amazing.
My eldest son is a researcher in the law and disability. And my youngest son is one of the lawyers for Grenville Tower. So, you know, they've grown up to be people I really respect.
Absolutely.
But what it was like at the time is a different question. And my youngest son actually went on Woman's Hour, and he made me promise not to listen to it, which I didn't do for years. But, I mean, he used to get a hell of a lot of shit at school.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I remember doing a radio program on Peak Welsh Radio with, what's his name? I can't remember, Chris somebody or other. And he said to me, asked me a question about, I can't remember how he phrased it, but my answer was, you know, it's better to, it was about lesbianism at the, and he hadn't told me he was going to ask me at the camp, and I said, well, isn't it better to love other women than to kill other people or something like that. And,
good answer.
But then, of course, the kids got a lot of stick for that because, you know, oh, your mum's a dyke, you know, which was true by that time anyhow. But, yeah, I think I can't answer for them, really.
Yeah, but they're amazing people, so it's obviously taken influence from you massively, impressive.
I like to think of that when it's, yeah, when I'm feeling really guilty, because I do feel guilty because, you know, I did get sort of so swept up in it, and I thought if I didn't do it, they'd die.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, we weren't, I don't think we were overreacting at all.
No. No, not at all.
And I, you know, the odd thing is I don't, you know, the last demonstration I went on was about 2 weeks ago, the Kill the Bill. Mm. But I went on an Extinction Rebellion one before that, and I've been on a couple of those. And nothing's changed. The world's still really, really in danger. It's not nuclear weapon, it's climate change, but time we behaved ourselves as a species, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. I wanted to talk to you a little bit about the art of Greenham. So do you have memories, like you've spoken briefly about singing, but singing and banners and artwork and poetry, how does that all link into Greenham?
I think what was extraordinary is it became so integral to everyday life. You know, you fried eggs, you made a poem, you fried another egg, you helped with the artwork or a banner. And it was, I think it's how ordinary life should be, where art and politics and cooking dinner and, you know, washing maybe, are all integrated, you know, that they're not separate things at all. And as a species, we've handed over so much control to other people. Mm. And people say, oh, you're a socialist. I'm not a socialist, actually. I've always been an anarchist. I think being brought up as a Catholic actually helps that, because it's about taking responsibility yourself. You know, there's no good waiting for somebody else to do something. Mm. You can do it with them, that's excellent, but waiting for other people to do it, if you can do it yourself, if you can't, then yeah, it's up to other people who can to do it. But Yeah, it's interesting because I think if you needed a huge banner or a piece of artwork, it just got done by who wasn't cooking dinner that night, you know. There was an assumption that anybody could do anything. And on the whole, anybody could do anything and probably can do anyhow, you know.
And where did your poem... So you had a poem published, didn't you?
I didn't know that. A friend of mine sent it off. I didn't know she'd sent it off. And she just said, oh, it's going to be in the Raving Beauties book. But no, I didn't send the poem off. It just arrived in the book. But I think I'm incredibly shy. And I think lots of people who've got big mouths and much to say, you know, are often very shy, you know, because you take on a persona.
Yeah, you're not being yourself.
So. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And as a kid, I wanted to be a dancer, ballet dancer. And I used to live, my mother was a cleaner in Colling Gardens. We lived in a basement flat, and it was, the house was, what was it called? A refuge for retired gentlewomen. So she used to get up at 6 in the morning and start cleaning. She used to go into the Red Cross at 6 at night and clean till 10 in the evening. So there was a church nearby. I think it was St. Luke's. I can't remember. And you couldn't go in unless you were a rich person. You know, all the people who worked for the rich people weren't allowed into the gardens. You weren't allowed a key, but at an early age, I'd learned how to climb over the fence. I knew where the gardener hid the key to the church hall. I thought, what I'll do is I'll give a show. So I wrote out all these invitations to this free show. And I knew where they kept, old wind-up gramophone.
Yeah.
And we got some lots of classical and ballet, you know, 78s. So I put all these notices through the door and opened the church hall one Thursday night, and loads of people came, and it was lovely. And then the vicar came. Somebody must have told the vicar, so. But it was only after about 2 hours, and we all got thrown out, and I got banned from the gardens. An old bloke who lived in the mews, who was a colonel, came up to me and said, you're a very good dancer. I want you to go and see somebody I know. Do you have ballet lessons? And I used to buy Girl Comic and School Friend. You know, you only went to ballet lessons if you were rich, which was, you know, it was true. So he gave me this link. Her name was Miss Bumble. Bunbury, Miss Bunbury. And she lived in Cheyne Walk. And I went to see her and she asked me to dance, and she had a ballet studio upstairs. And the ballet studio had a bar, but it had mirrors. And the mirrors reflected the light from the Thames. So that, you know, the whole room shimmered when you were dancing. Yeah, and she said that she'd teach me for free with the, you know, the rich kids, which she did. And then she put me in for a scholarship. I think it was called a Cecchetti scholarship. I remember going home and telling my mum and dad, and I was so thrilled. And they said, oh, you can't do it. We're going to move. And we did, and I didn't do it. But I always wanted to act or dance. And when my first two kids were at school, I went for an audition. I think it was at the Mercury Theatre in Notting Hill, and got a part. So, and then I worked in the theatre for about 3 years, I think. But then, my husband said it's either the theatre or the family. So I gave it up.
Seems to be a lot of other people making decisions about your life.
I think so. And you could say, well, why are you so stupid to allow them to do that?
No, not at all.
But I think when there's children involved, and, you know, I did feel guilty about it. Although they were looked after during out of school time if I wasn't there by a woman who had a parrot. And the person opposite in Richmond had a monkey, so it was quite a good place to be a kid.
That's an amazing place to be. What were the relationships like with the local residents of Newbury when you were at Greenwich Experience?
I think they were sort of I think they were terribly mixed, actually. Mm-hmm. I mean, there were people who really hated us being there. I think, who was the, was it Trust House 40 or somebody, who banned us, actually, banned us going into the coffee shops and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't want to sound like an old-fashioned liberal, but I think when you stop and you actually talk to people, it really helps a lot, you know, whether it's the police or the US Army. Or, well, the only time I've been thrown down by a US Army person, she was a woman. She threw us down on the concrete. So, I mean, there was, you know, the worst, some real violent moments. But the local people, I think we were a bloody nuisance. And they said we smelt funny, which is almost certainly true, because if you sit around the fire a lot, you smell of the fire, you know. It'd be interesting to know what they think of us now, as opposed to what they thought of us then.
Definitely.
I think people, I mean, we looked scruffy. We probably were scruffy. I still look scruffy. I look just as scruffy as I did then. I think we were a nuisance.
Yeah.
But then if the police, the new police bill goes through, you'll be arrested for being an annoyance. So.
Yeah.
Let's make sure that we all carry on being annoying. I can't really, I can give you an impression of what local people thought. I mean, sometimes they'd come and they'd really shout at you and it would be, and I think we were an inconvenience as well.
And what about the military and the police? You said, like, there were some violent moments, but some you could do and they'd listen.
Yeah, I think there were violent moments, as I say, when we got in once and the US were in there and the woman in charge got me and threw me down onto the concrete. But that was really unusual. And it's funny because the other day somebody was asking me about the declaration I'd made when I went to America. And she said to me, was there any violence? And I said, no, not that I can remember. She said, well, why don't you read your declaration? So I read it. And there's an incident described where the US Army said, you know, if you put your hands near that fence, you know, we'll have you. And this woman puts her fingers through the fence and just pushes the fence about 2 centimetres. And he sort of karate chops her hand and there's blood everywhere. And she, and it was me. And I really, you know, you've got selective memory, haven't you? Because I didn't remember it as soon as I read it, because I had to read it out. As soon as I read it, I thought, yes, I do remember this. And I had to go to the hospital and stuff. But I also think, you know, he said, don't touch that fence. And I thought, buggy you. I mean, I was winding him up as much as he was winding me up.
But you weren't hurting anyone.
I wasn't. No, he really did hurt me, actually. He did. But it's amazing what you choose not to remember.
Yeah, it is.
But on the whole, I found, and I used to have, you know, I had quite serious disagreements with other women about this. Because I do think if you talk to people and explain, it does help. I was just thinking about, you know, my children. I remember my younger son letting the police car tyres down at an action in Wales. And my older son, there was an anti-National Front march in Cardiff and I was on that, and I don't know where he was. Anyhow, that night we were watching television and there were some, you know, some teenagers lobbing lumps of just mud at the protesters. And I remember saying, you know, in a really self-righteous way, oh, that isn't the way to deal with things. And I realised it was my son. It was my oldest son. And my daughter and I, after Chernobyl, decided we needed to do something. We went together into... I'd already been banned from the House of Commons because I'd got arrested there with the Greenham women in the crypt. So I said to my daughter, I mustn't give my right name. So they came along and asked me my name. I said, Carol Harwood. And I gave it to them. Well, they didn't do anything. We were dressed up as tourists and we had sort of, you know, diamond earrings and mascara and, you know, big, really big sort of designer bags. And they were going to have this debate on Chernobyl, but there was another debate first. So we got in right into the centre of the Strangers Gallery. It was still open in those days. And gradually we weren't supposed to be there because we'd only booked for the one debate, but it started to fill up, and it, like Greenpeace protesters and Friends of the Earth. And so we were right in the centre. And when they started the debate, what we'd got in our bag, and they searched our bags, but we'd got it in the lining, was flour, you know, just self-raising flour, and spring blossoms and leaflets. And we had to decide which one of us was going to stand up and give the speech and which one was going to go and empty the flowers and the leaflets over the MP. So we tossed for it. And I don't know if I won or I lost. I think I probably lost. So she said that she wanted to go to the loo and sort of got out, got down to the very front. And nobody, I mean, she looked so posh, nobody bothered. And she opened her bag and she just emptied the flower and the flower petals and the leaflets over the MPs. And it was an incredible moment because the flower, because it had been compacted, as she shook it over the MPs, it rose in a sort of, you know, nuclear cloud, you know, above them. And it just has, and they came to drag her off. So I had to stand up and start to make a speech, which I did. And I thought, well, it'll only be 2 seconds, you know, because they'll drag me out. And bloody hell, the Friends of the Earth and Greenpeace all put their feet across the benches. So nobody could get through. So I had to keep on. I was praying, please take me away. Please come and grab me. So gave my maiden speech in the House of Commons. And it seemed to go on for 20 minutes. I think it was about 5 minutes, but it was a long time. So, yeah, they grew up to be good kids.
Absolutely. Do you see any of these tactics being used anywhere now, these kind of non-violent direct action?
Yeah, I see it with the Extinction Rebellion sit-ins, but I don't think, I mean, I went on the Kill the Bill demonstration.
Yeah.
Which was in the march, it was good. And we went to Parliament Square and we sat down and that was good. But you could also see, and this was 2 years ago, you could also see that there were elements that really wanted to punch up with the police.
Mm.
And I don't know if I'd say it was stronger now than it was then. Because you're in danger of looking at the good old days, you know, when we all behaved much better. And I don't think we did really. But, and the last 18 months have been so weird.
Yes. Yeah.
So you can save the planet but infect your neighbour. I've got a great granddaughter.
Yeah.
I remember singing a song with Extinction Rebellion, you know, about 18 months ago. And one of the lines was, you know, about your great-granddaughter. And I thought, God, what must it be like to have a great-granddaughter? I've now got a great-granddaughter. Yeah. So I'd quite like the world to continue and get better for her and for everybody.
Yes, absolutely. What did it mean to you? Why do you think the decision was made to make Greenham women only, a women only camp?
Because men are dicks. I mean, they are so, they cannot help but think that they should be in control because they think they know better. And I think fuck all has changed there, really. I mean, you have another layer of oppression to scramble through before you get to the government, you know. And you know, I know it's a huge generalisation, but and you know, I was uncertain about the decision for about 3 minutes, and the fact that, you know, Greenham was women only, I think, was incredibly important. I don't think we'd have done half the things that we'd have done if the men had been involved. That's not to say that, you know, we were all nice and kind to each other and there was no conflict. There was a hell of a lot of conflict. There were issues that, you know, a lot of people didn't want to address, you know, let alone do something about. I mean, diversity was a real issue at Greenham. It was essentially white. It was often essentially middle class. And to sort of raise those issues often caused... I'm trying to think of a polite word. It caused battles, actually. It caused battles.
And how were they resolved? How were they resolved? So how was conflict managed?
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that, really. It was, you know, it used to be resolved because it had to be, you know, if you had to be sort of out doing something deeply illegal, you're going to have to do it anyhow, so you just have to stop arguing about stuff.
Yeah, and you say it was quite white middle class, but there were, I mean, you yourself were, you know, you were from Care, and I know we've interviewed at least one of the women who came from Care, and people from different backgrounds. Do you think that the different people from different backgrounds tended to group together, or what did people mix? And
I think they would have done if they could have done, but very often there weren't enough. You know, which was the issue in the first place. And sometimes you had really sort of odd moments, you know, talking about diversity. I remember meeting a black woman at Greenham, I think it's on Christmas Eve, and she was Michael Foot's chauffeur. And he brought down a Stilton cheese and some good wine. I mean, I was very fond of Michael Foot. You know, for fuck's sake, you know. that's the sort of, you know, that's the sort of amusing one, but it sort of mirrors the balance of power, I think, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. How did the kind of collective decision-making work? Apparently no leaders. What did that look like?
I'm an anarchist and I believe in no leaders. I've very rarely seen anything be organised that didn't have leaders. And, you know, I say that as one of the plaintiffs who went to America. You know, as one of the people who went and lectured at Harvard, you know, who the fuck am I to, you know, to say about leadership? I don't, people with ideas and ideas about how to organise carrying out those ideas, they're not called leaders. But because somebody's not called a leader doesn't mean that they're not a leader. And it depends how you define leadership.
Everyone's opinions listened to form a plan of direct actions and things.
I think people really did try, actually, to be fair. I think people did try to listen to. I remember that the, I think she was an Italian woman who wanted us to do the silo action naked. You know, go naked over, you know. And I think we, you know, we all listened, but we all knew bloody well we were not going to take our knickers off to go over the barbed wire.
Yeah.
So, you know, people were, you know, I think, I hope that people will listen to. But, you know, one of the things about leadership is you have to, you know, you've got a round table of equality, but who lets those equals in the first place? You know, it's, some, you know, some things are self-defined, you know, so that people with ideas and the ability to sort of organise those ideas, they won't call themselves leaders, but they probably will be. You know. I think it's complex, yeah, but I think it's something to be careful of, very careful of.
What do you think the legacy is of Greenham within the peace movements?
You see, you talked, we were in the pub the other day, and one of the young guys said, oh, you were talking about Greenham. And he knew about Greenham. He must have been, well, he wasn't 12, otherwise he wouldn't be working in the pub, but he was really young and he knew about Greenham. And that really surprised me.
Yeah.
And I remember when Emma and I actually got locked up in the tower, you know, the clock tower, Big Ben, when we'd done the action in the in Parliament, you know, for Chernobyl.
Mm-hmm.
And loads of MPs and stuff came up and brought us tea and biscuits and things. But one of the people who were looking after us said, oh, we had an exhibition about you sort of ladies the other week. And we said, well, what was that? He said, oh, the suffragettes. And we glowed and we sort of tingled and we thought, oh, that's great. So that you are in a tradition. I think if you've been really involved in something, you perhaps lose sight of its separate impact, you know. It's just something you did. But I think the... I think it has made a, you know, a huge imprint, really. I mean, I think the non-violence was incredibly important, but also the numbers, the mass numbers. I mean, you're talking about thousands and thousands. Yeah, it'd be interesting to ask people, you know, what did, you know, do they even know what Greenham Common was?
Yeah, our experience has been that on the whole, no. People under 40 or, you know, even around that age, there's either, sorry, you're going to have to tell me, I've kind of heard of it, but don't know.
Or yeah.
Completely, sorry, I don't know what you're talking about. So it's nice to hear that the young man in the pub did know about it.
Yeah, he did. And what you're doing will actually have a huge impact too.
Hopefully.
I think it will. I think it really will. You know.
Why do you think it's important for Greenham to be remembered, you know, to for future generations?
Because Mr. Gorbachev said it should be remembered. I mean, he actually said, didn't he, that, you know, the Greenham women made,
yeah,
you know, made the test ban treaty possible. And Michael Heseltine said he thought we ought to be shot. Well, that's two good reasons for remembering Greenham, really. And also that the positive stuff, that you can change things, you can change things. You know, we're hurtling towards, you know, climate crisis. But you can change it. You can intervene. You can say stop, you know. You can redirect the traffic. You can do that. You can do it literally and you can do it metaphorically. But you have to... And knowing that people have done it before, Yeah, I think it's really important. I think what you're doing is really important. Because also you're doing it for the right reasons.
Yeah, I hope so. We want people to learn from you all and continue to make a difference.
I'll drink to that.
Thank you so much for speaking to us this morning, Carol. I appreciate it so much.
I really appreciate it too. And thank you for the work you're doing.